Hello and welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on Leadership with Scott Miller. I'm your host each week, 6 years and 350 episodes, where every Tuesday and Friday we interview some of the most fascinating, interesting, and influential people in the world. It could be experts in leadership or AI. Sometimes it's around building culture or marketing. In many cases, it's around behaviors to become a more effective and influential independent contributor or even leader. Regardless of where you are in your own leadership journey, formally or informally, we like to shine Franklin Covey's megawatt spotlight onto both thought leaders from inside the organization. Perhaps it's Ann Chow, Stephen M. R. Covey, Chris McChesney, Corey Kogan, and others. Or perhaps, like today, is someone outside the organization that we think can inspire you to greatness in your life. Today, we have Aaron Ralston. Now, he may not be a household name, but as soon as you hear his story, you will know exactly who he is. He's authored a book. He's had a major motion picture based on his life. He is a keynote speaker around the world. In just a moment, I'm going to introduce his story to you. However, for some suspense, we'll keep you hanging. Aaron Ralston, welcome to On Leadership.
It's great to be with you, Scott. Thanks so much.
Aaron, great to have you here. We taped this podcast from Salt Lake City. You have a very memorable experience from your time in Utah. You are originally trained and educated as a mechanical engineer. You retired very shortly into a very successful career and decided to pursue other things. One of those things was, of course, mountain climbing and rock climbing. 20 years ago, just this past spring, you had an incident where your arm was trapped by a boulder, and you are known now to the world as the Aaron who literally cut his arm off to escape and live. Most people know James Franco played your character in a major motion picture. There's a book that you've written. Let's talk about that journey, but maybe you would rewind, because who doesn't want to hear the fascinating journey of deciding to save your life by saving yourself from your arm? Aaron, will you rewind a little bit, talk about your education, your upbringing, and how you got so interested in the outdoors?
Yeah, I appreciate it. I started off, I was very successful in school and graduated at the top of my class in high school, went on to Carnegie Mellon, graduating at the top of my class there, and not only mechanical engineering, also with a degree in French literature and piano performance. So I was aspired to be a fairly well-rounded kind of Renaissance type of guy, but it was also very much an ego exercise for me, because I was a bookish nerd, not very athletic in elementary, middle school. I got bullied, teased a lot, ostracized, excluded. And so there were compensation strategies that I developed along those years to kind of prove that I was good enough, that, I'm not the cool kid, but I'll show you all how successful I'm going to be. And that carried me through. It gave me motivation. It was, a little bit of my own personal, revenge. But just, I think for a lot of us as humans, that we are seeking that kind of validation, that we are enough as who we are in our lives. Certainly then getting into mountaineering, started with skiing in Colorado. My family moved out west when I was 11 years old. And that led to a passion for being in the mountains. However, I could manage that, whether it was hiking in the summertime or eventually climbing in the winter. As I started a project to try to summit all of the 14,000 foot high mountains that we have in Colorado. Here, there are 59 of them by my count. And to climb them all as no one had ever done them before, which is to do them solo in the wintertime. As you can probably imagine, that's highly dangerous. There's a reason no one ever had attempted or accomplished that feat. And at the point when I was about 75% of the way through that was when I decided to leave my career, as you mentioned, that I decided to set aside mechanical engineering. I left the corporate world and I moved to Aspen, Colorado, in the heart of these 14,000 foot high mountains, where I began working at a mountaineering shop and living my dream. To climb these mountains. I wanted to become a mountain guide. And it was in an off season of that when in the spring of 2003, where I decided to go out to the desert for, kind of, let's say, a poor man's beach vacation. You save money because there's no water anywhere. But to be out there in the canyon country, getting some, you know, sun on my face and some sand in my shoes, and very fateful hike then when I walked into Blue John Canyon on April 26th of that year.
Let's recap some of that, because this is a fascinating journey. Long before your incident in Utah, we'll talk about in just a moment, I mean, you graduated top of your class. In high school, you went on and earned a mechanical engineering degree from Carnegie Mellon with an education also in French literature and piano. I mean, these are not things you typically associate with mountain climbers. Maybe that's true. Maybe most of you are speaking French and are playing piano at the base. But a fascinating conundrum. And then you, after 5 years, I think it was, with Intel, you retired. You said, I'm done. Like, you retired in your 20s. And you said, I'm done. And you made some vows to yourself that you were going to live a different life. And so you decided to climb mountains and descent and ascent. And then something fateful happened on a descent in 2003. Mm-hmm. Here you are in southern Utah in an area known as Blue John Canyon. And I'd love to just sit back and have you share the story, because I think it's best that I just be quiet and have you talk for a little bit, because people are going to be interested in what led up to this incident, what was going through your mind. Talk about the number of days and share as much detail as you're willing to.
Yeah, of course. And it is a story that people, you know, generally know the outcome of what happened. So, you know, spoiler alert, I'm the guy that cut his arm off. But as I tell this story, my emphasis is on the fact that I'm the guy who was smiling when he cut his arm off. And that smile is what makes all the difference in what this story means, not just to me, but I think to other people. And so as I go through this, I'd like for people to reflect about the boulders that are in their lives, as I make a metaphor about it, that there are adversities and challenges all around us that we're dealing with. I'm right now still in the midst of an ongoing custody issues with my kids, that I've lost my dad to a disease 5 years ago. It was just his birthday a week ago. I was reflecting and remembering him. But it was my dad who also taught me that it's not what happens to us, it's how we respond. That's how we get to define our lives. And the response, the mindset, the choices that we make about what does befall us and how we're going to use it to grow, that's hopefully what I'd ask the listeners, the viewers here to reflect about whatever it is that feels like is burdening them, that's crushing them, that's sucking the life force out of them, to also maybe even consider that it could be something that is going to help you grow, that might even be something that you could reflect on in the future to be grateful for, and thereby to perhaps shift your mindset around, instead of resisting it, to welcome it and to be grateful for it. So, again, to come back to that smile. But yeah, I started out on this hike back in late April 2003 on some vacation time from when I was living in Aspen. I drove, it's really only about 3.5 hours or so to get from the mountains out to the desert. And I had a 5-day vacation. I was mountain biking and exploring other canyons. But by Saturday, the third day of my vacation, I was out in Blue John Canyon, named for one of the henchmen of Butch Cassidy's gang. He had one blue eye and one brown eye. So Blue John was his name. And this was a canyon that they would rendezvous in after holding up a bank or stealing some horses, robbing a train, that they'd ride out into the desert, rendezvous in this this hole in the earth, and outlast the vigilante posses coming for them. So as remote an area still today as it was 130 years ago, I biked for about 15 miles from where I left my vehicle in order to get to the head of the canyon. And then I was going to hike 15 miles down through the canyon to get back to my truck by the end of the day. So I am out in the desert, marching along. It's about noon. I drop into the canyon after the bike ride is done. I come across two young women, Megan and Christy, who were out from Outward Bound. They were working for an outfitter company, an adventure of their own. We joined up for a 5 miles or so through the main slot of Blue John, where it's only really about 3 feet across in places. It's 100 feet deep, 10 stories up to the very narrow sliver of sky that you can see up there, that we were having a great time. For a couple hours, we're moving along. I tried to get them to continue down, keep going all the way back to where my vehicle was. They tried to get me to come out with them. So we parted ways, made a plan to get together the following day, but I was now on my own. And mid-afternoon, about 2:45, I get to the lower slot of Blue John in the main fork there. Here's, again, just barely more than shoulder width and 4-5 stories deep. I drop to a spot where there's about a 12-foot dry waterfall. Of course, these canyons are the storm drains of the desert when there's a big thunderhead that comes along, a monsoon. And this day, it was bluebird skies. It was about 80 degrees out, but much cooler down in the slot, kind of the wine cellar effect of being down in the earth like that. I'm at a what's called a cascade of boulders, where chalk stones, rocks have fallen into the canyon, become wedged between the narrow walls there. And if you can think of it almost like a staircase of boulders in front of me at my feet to the 12-foot drop off there at the bottom where the continuing canyon floor flows away from me. I had to maneuver this set of obstacles, but they were almost stacked like stepping stones. So the first one, though, the largest, about the size of a bus tire, I know I'm going to need to kind of dangle my body off of it to get to the next in the sequence. And at that point, I test the rock, I kick at it, make sure it's stable enough, I stand on it, and I get in the position where now I'm climbing down off of that rock, where I'm holding on to it, and I get to full extension where I'm grabbing on to the boulder and dangling my body below it. And that's when I pulled it loose. I fall to the bottom of the canyon. And of course, the split second reaction is to protect my head. There's a huge 1,000-pound boulder falling from my skull. And so I put my hands up to try to protect myself, get my head out of the way successfully, but I've exposed my hands. The rock smashes into both of my hands, kind of ricocheting between the walls. And my right arm pushing, probably because it was my dominant hand pushing harder than my left, it slips into a gap between the boulder and the wall of the canyon, just as that rock then slams down in front of my chest and becomes wedged once more as it had been between the walls of the canyon. But now it's ensnared my arm into this impossibly small shadow between the boulder and the canyon wall.
I'm speechless. I'm riveted trying to think about this. When that happened, did you obviously try to like wedge your arm out, and for how long? Did you have like a sensation of, I'm gonna be fine, I'll figure it out, I'm gonna die? Like what happened in the first couple of seconds, minute, as you're trying to really ascertain the severity of the situation?
Yeah, and I think, for again, to come back to that metaphor, for folks, like very few of us have ever had a huge chunk of sandstone fall on one of our body parts, but that feeling of panic, of fear, of pain, of having our world turned upside down, inside out, all in the same moment, there was a total loss of control. I certainly was trying to rip my arm free. I'm trying to lift the boulder because I just made it move. Why can't I make it move again? I'm trying to pull it. I was in a fury, and this rage went on for 15 minutes, a half an hour, 45 minutes, before I was only ultimately finally able to stop and to take a few deep breaths. And this is it's a very fundamental and basic rubric for kind of a crisis management response, that to stop, and it's STOP, to stop, take those breaths, T, think, get back into your functioning, rational problem-solving mind, which as a mechanical engineer is very much a strong suit for me. O is to make some observations, come up with some options, and P, decide on a plan. So as I'm going through that, it was still within the first hour that I even said out loud, Aaron, you're going to have to cut your arm off. I didn't want to. It freaked me out. I even said, like, I don't want to cut my arm off. But I understood the very severe and serious situation that I was in, that if I was otherwise uninjured, aside from my trapped hand, but of course, not being able to extricate myself, I'd never be able to get out of there. I had 1 liter of water when I became trapped. You need more like a gallon to survive for every 24 hours that you're out in the desert. And so I knew that my water source and therefore my life was on a very limited countdown. But I began working, trying to use my pocket knife to try to cut through the rock, to excavate my hand. It took me through the first night to Sunday morning, 15 hours of working, but I only removed half of a golf ball of sandstone, just the most minute amount compared to perhaps more like a basketball that I would have to remove to get my hand free. I knew I didn't have time to keep working on that. That option was out. But trying to lift the rock, I had my climbing gear. I was prepared for some rappels that were farther along in the canyon. I rigged that up, created an anchor up above me, and began trying to lift the rock with the rope. But I didn't have a steel cable. I wasn't using actual pulleys. This was all improvised, and the losses of force meant that I'd effectively created a mechanical disadvantage system. I was not going to be able to lift that rock off my arm. Waiting for help, like, oh, maybe Megan and Christy would come back, or perhaps other canyoneers, or at some point, like a passing aircraft that I might signal. But no one was coming, and my efforts to communicate with the outside world were highly constrained. That, you know, I didn't have a radio, or there's no cell phone signals out there, which meant I was on my own. And it meant that I had to reconsider after about 24 hours of being trapped, like, okay, now this is the last option, cutting my arm off. If I'm going to do this, how can I mitigate the outcomes here? That, of course, blood loss being a significant factor, I wanted to try to, blood loss being a significant factor that I wanted to try to staunch that as much as possible with an improvised tourniquet that I stripped off of my camelback hose, the insulation. So this is one of those little backpacks with the drinking tube coming over your shoulder. I used that insulation as it's thin and stretchable, neoprene. That becomes my tourniquet. And now I'm ready to at least think about cutting my arm off. But as I held the knife to my arm, I understood what? I'm still 8 miles from my truck, and then a 60-mile drive out of a washboarded winding road. And I even chuckled to myself, like, why did I have to buy a stick shift truck? It's just the idea of, like, yeah, even if I make it that far, I'm going to end up upside down in a ditch, possibly in an explosion fireball, that I just knew it was a slow act of suicide to try to cut my arm off. I took the tourniquet off at that point, and I got my camera out. And at that, I was able to look into the lens and talk to my family, say my goodbyes, tell them I love them, that I was sorry, that I was grateful and thankful for everything that they'd contributed to my life. And I believe that this is the point that really things started to turn around for me, because that was where I got in touch with the most powerful motivation that I could possibly find in my life, which is that it's not just what I'm going to do for myself here, but what wouldn't you do for the people that you love most in the world, to get back to them, to be able to protect a relationship, to continue on, and to connect in love. That was the first and probably most significant gift that boulder would give to me over the coming days, was to understand that it's not just the will to live, but it was the will to love that was going to keep me going. And to know that even as deep as the despair would get, that if I just turned on that video camera and looked into the lens of my camcorder again, that I could feel connected, I could feel love, I would feel lifted up, and I had everything I needed, my strength and courage and resilience and grit, perseverance and determination, that it was all there for me by looking through that camera lens and connecting with the people, my loved ones. I hope that people, you know, listening again can reflect and see that in that moment of crisis, in the time when it feels like everything's upside down, that even as isolated as I was, and perhaps as isolated as we can feel in those moments of crisis, but that we are not alone, and that it's to reach out, to connect, to bring in the relationships, and to draw the strength and courage that we need from those people and those relationships, that that's how we're able to move forward. And I think that's valuable, whether you're a leader or an individual, as just as a human being, we're all going to go through these adversities and these crises. And to know what is most important in life, and to draw your determination and your perseverance from that.
I'm speechless. I can't even fathom what you've told us thus far. I don't think the idea of cutting off my arm ever would have occurred to me, because I don't have the willpower, I don't have the perseverance, the know-how to do that. I think I probably would have struggled to free myself until I became exhausted and ran out of water and passed out and died, I guess. I would have done it my best. There's no way I would have taken the water tube off of my backpack and created a tourniquet. Within the first hour, did you say you had decided you would need to cut off your arm? Did I get that right?
I knew it was on the list. You know, I was brainstorming. I was going through my STOP, you know, and I'm thinking and coming up with options. But it was at the bottom of the list, to be clear, except by, you know, the second day, everything else has failed. And so now it's the only option left. Like, I couldn't wait for help. No one was coming. As far as an intentional rescue, I'd made an error in my protocols. Normally, I left, you know, written out information about where I was going to be with my roommates, or I would call my mom and let her know when I was out on one of these, you know, winter solo 14er expeditions. But in this instance, it was like, this is just a walk in the park. You know, I felt, inordinately overconfident, perhaps, because like, oh, this is not a 14er in the wintertime. And still, obviously, the consequence of that became quite real. And I saw how I created this situation. And a lesson in accountability then developed for me, as I understood that I had played a significant role in getting myself into this, but that was how I was going to retain the power to get myself out of here. So I want to reinforce that when we are responsible to ourselves and accountable for our actions and our role in things, that's how we can move forward. I think too often if we push our own responsibility aside, then that means that we're kind of stuck in a situation where, okay, but now what do I do? Because it was somebody else's fault, or, you know, maybe it was just the universe conspiring against me. But I took that as, okay, it's an idea. Now I started to try to plan it out a little bit more by the second day. By the third day, I realized, like, okay, I'm going to die here. And even if I die on the way out of here, maybe the probabilities there are better than the certainty that I'm facing in this spot. I wasn't just standing in the bottom of a canyon. I was standing in my grave. So I tried on, it was now Monday morning, the third day that I was there. But the knife, because I'd been dulling it against the boulder, trying to carve through the rock, it was so dull that I couldn't even cut the hair off my skin, let alone like saw into my arm. So I hit bottom, but once again, pulled up my camera, talked to my loved ones, said thank you, reminisced about favorite trips, you know, going to the national parks with my family, learning how to ski with my sister, you know, climbing mountains with my friends, and going to concerts together, all the great memories. And that, again, lifted me up. I felt buoyed by all the gratitude that I had in my life for all the people who had shared it with me. That kept me going through the third afternoon, you know, rationing my food and water. But by the fourth morning, I was out of water. And now, again, the calculus of this is shifted even more pointedly to say, like, I'm going to die soon here. What else can I do to get out? And I realized that you don't just have to hold a knife like a saw, but you can also hold it like a dagger. And I'm laughing because it was almost as if I heard the psycho sound effect, like wee, 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 in the canyon as I stabbed myself. And I plunged the knife into my arm, which was success. It was progress. Like, oh, I thought I wouldn't even be able to cut through the hair, but I wouldn't get to the skin. But now I was inside my arm and I'm probing around, stop, okay, think, breathe, observe, options, plan. And as I gain information, like, okay, but the bone in there, how could I possibly cut through the bone? This knife, it's so dull. I'd be sooner probably able to slice through the boulder than to get through the bone. Again, despair, hitting bottom. But once more, again, with my camera, I'm looking through the lens. It was this process over and over again. It's like practicing meditation or yoga that, yes, you're gonna lose your mind at times, but to come back and to reground and center and understand, again, get in touch with what's important, find your strength. And for me, it was then just holding on. Okay, maybe somebody might come. Maybe I'll figure this out. The fourth night turns to the fifth day. And that was a different phase for me. The fifth day, having totally outlasted, doubling even the amount of time that I thought I could survive without adequate water, I was now at a place of just acceptance. And that brought me peace. Like, okay, it doesn't matter if I cut my arm, if I don't. I mean, at this point, out of water, I was drinking my own urine, but you know, that wasn't exactly helping. But whether I did that more or not, it just wasn't up to me. And I found this feeling of calm that came from letting go. And I hadn't let go of hope, but I was letting go of control. And I think for especially a lot of folks that might, you know, high performing, maybe even executives, leaders, that we kind of get in a trap, or we can at least, of thinking that if we just try a little harder, that we can exert our will in a situation, and that's going to get us an outcome that we want. Maybe sometimes, and then there are going to be times when that's not true. And to align yourself with the will of the universe is what can bring us peace then. And that's how I made it through the fifth day, but to a very faithful fifth night. And this was where I knew I was going to die. I carved my name, my epitaph, into the wall of the canyon. It was there in stone now. But at a point, and somewhere in the middle of the darkest hours there, I had an out-of-body experience where I found myself walking into a living room. There was a little 3.5-year-old boy, and this child came running into my arms. I scooped him up, and his eyes, these beautiful, brilliant blue eyes, I'm getting a little emotional. Because it was a vision of my future son that I would someday see, and I knew then that meant that I was going to get out of there. That little boy just changed everything. And somehow I made it to the next dawn that I'd said I was not going to see. And the sixth morning, I was still there, 124 hours of being out in the desert alone. But how am I going to get out of here? How can I cut my arm off 125 hours, 126 hours, until at 127 hours, it finally, like, talk about light bulbs. This was megawatts of electricity going off in my brain as I understand that it was torque, that I could use the boulder. Just, you don't have to cut the bone, Aaron, break the bone. And this smile comes across my face as I understand there was no reluctance or resistance at all, but I bend my arm and I push against the rock and I snap the bone in my arm, and the smile gets bigger because I'm going to get out of there. I'm going to get home. I'm going to get a hug from my mom. I'm going to maybe someday see that little boy. And then that was when I realized there are actually two bones in your forearm there. But what am I going to do? Stop now? Like, again? Yeah, again. I reversed the forces. Again, the mechanical engineering mind, my kind of the way I talk to myself. I bend up and pull with my hand over the top of the rock, and crack! The bottom bone breaks in the same spot. And now I'm smiling, the biggest smile that I think I've ever smiled in my life, because I'm through this. I'm going to get out of here. And it was just a little over an hour of cutting. And I felt all of it, but I never even said ow or shed a tear. There were no cries. It was with this burgeoning and growing smile on my face as I'm doing something absolutely horrific, like no doubt. But what I was making it mean was that it was giving me my life back. And how much more powerful and positive can something be than to be doing that, to be taking that action, to liberate myself, to get me home to my loved ones. And in those final moments, then it was to cut through the nerve, like an order of magnitude more intense than anything I've ever felt in my life. But again, deep breaths, and that smile comes back. And finally, as I got through the last piece of skin and I stepped free, I was released from the boulder. And in fact, there was this tension that was cut, and I almost fell back in the canyon. And it was the most powerful moment of my life there, that I was flooded with possibility of every moment of joy and delight and happiness and just pleasure, that all the good that life has in store for any and all of us, that it was there for me all in one moment, where it was infinite in its possibility. We're not programmed to be able to handle that much. So that was when I almost passed out, but I calmed myself. I brought myself back again, deep breathing. And I got my camera out and I focused it on what was in front of me. And yeah, there was the severed hand with the bone end sticking out and blood going down the wall, but it was trash. This was not a souvenir photograph. It was the boulder. And I pushed the button to say thank you, out of the gratitude that I had for what the rock had given me, and understanding what's so important about the values in my life, the relationships, the people that gave me the strength to do all of this, to understand the possibilities in my life of that I was much more capable than I could possibly imagine myself of being, and to understand that smile that even in the most extraordinary of times that really our mind is wow, just like that it's that strong that we might even be able to be smiling at something. It's just that outlandish, that crazy. It was not over at that point, but certainly the escape, eventually the rescue that would happen. I would have to hike for 5 miles, 6 miles, 7 miles. And after 5 hours of trying to escape, finally a helicopter flew over, landed, plucked me out of the canyon. And I knew that it wasn't just a black helicopter, but it was my mom who had coordinated an entire search and rescue operation that got me out of there, not even knowing what state I was in. I mean, the miracle of this is just is beyond comprehension. But that within minutes of me bleeding to death and minutes of that helicopter running out of fuel, they got me to the hospital. And my life was saved.
Aaron, I mean, I almost passed out twice listening to this story. I had to grip the table because it's incomprehensible. I mean, this could be a 3-hour interview. All of our listeners right now are going through the same emotion that I am, which is indescribable. I mean, Herculean, fantastical, macabre, desperate, heroic. What do you want everyone listening and watching today to do differently after having listened to your perseverance during those 127 hours? Everyone's got a creditor who's calling them for a bill that's late. Everyone's got a job they're struggling with, or an interpersonal problem, or health issue, some issue that seems insurmountable. What do you want people to do differently, to how to believe in themselves as a result of listening to this story that leaves anyone speechless?
I appreciate that question, especially because it for me, the meaning in all of this is that we get to choose what we're going to do with all of those challenges like that you were just talking about, or what I get to do with the challenges in my life. I have mental health issues, dealing with depression and anxiety, as I have for most of my adulthood, that I've mentioned, you know, that there's legal and custody stuff, of course, just being a parent and trying to raise two kids, especially as one of them's a teenager now, like that all of this, these boulders that are all around us and that they're going to keep coming. So we get to choose what we're going to do with them. And if all we do is experience the burden of them and we can't find meaning or purpose in them, then yeah, that's just stress. And you can only deal with so much stress. But to shift your perspective about what something is, and that rather than seeing it as a burden, but maybe even to find the blessings that are there, to be able to take that boulder and turn it into a gift, to receive the gifts that are here for us in the adversities and the challenges, that's how we can take that adversity and turn it into an advantage, even, because it's going to help us grow. So I think, you know, yeah, in the depths of it, it's enough to just still be there, to live to fight another day, to make it through a long, dark night of the soul, to be able to come through and to see a dawn that you didn't think you were going to see. That's enough. And then in perhaps, you know, more time, you get your footing under you, you're able to start to actually apply and to grow, that's where you can cultivate some gratitude for your time, for your experience. Any of us looking back in our lives, look at how this has created us, of who we are in this moment, and to think that, yeah, when life feels like it's falling apart right now, that's how we are going to become the person who is in the future, looking back and being grateful about what we've gone through to get to that point in our lives. So I think to have that kind of perspective, if maybe at the very least to have the perspective that, hey, if you didn't have to drink your own urine, come on, like how bad is it? But I use all of this for myself, you know, to remember too, that even like while I was trapped, I was struck by the beauty of the place that I was in. That I, of course, had my camera that I could connect and to practice gratitude. So I think there's a lot of opportunities along the way as we meet challenges that we can use these kinds of tools, that it's to have some perspective about, okay, you know, I've been through something really big in the past, and now that gives me the confidence to know I can move through this too. Maybe it's about finding a relationship to draw closer with, and that's certainly what happened when my dad was ill. It was pancreatic cancer. He had about 6 months, and we drew in with our family and with our extended family, and to just be relishing in the preciousness of that time. All of these can be responses to a difficult moment, a crisis, again, having our life turned upside down. And there are going to be so many of them. So I know it's not just like one answer, but I do think that any and all of these answers that I'm trying to share might be able to help someone to remember that there's some light in the world, even beyond, you know, the darkness that can feel like it's enshrouding you in a particular time.
Aaron, there are many ways I could debrief this, but I'm not going to. I'm going to end the interview here and let all of our listeners and viewers just ponder on what is their boulder and recognize their will is probably stronger than they recognize. Aaron Ralston, your book is 127 Hours, has turned into a major motion picture, was a New York Times best-selling author. You are in a frequently demanding position as a keynote speaker. I can imagine all the organizations that are listening to this story and want to hire you to do just that. If someone wants to learn more about you or how to work with you, what's the best way for people to contact you?
Through either Kepler Speakers, that's my agency, my bureau for speaking events. They coordinate all of that for me. And also my own personal website, AaronRalstonSpeaker.com, has links both to Kepler and as well as information contacts. So I definitely appreciate the chance to share my story. And I guess I just want to summarize it, is that with the love of our relationships, that's what gives us that strength and courage to make the transformation of those boulders and turn them into the blessings in our lives. So I hope people will take that and be able to implement it when they encounter their next greatest adversity too.
Aaron, you may not be a great mountain climber, but you're a great storyteller.
I'm kidding.
You obviously are extraordinarily talented. Thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Yeah. No, my pleasure so much. Thank you, Scott.
And we'll see you back here next week for a new conversation on survivorship. I mean leadership.